Hi, and welcome to the Easton Bible Church podcast. We're so excited you've joined us today. Our hope is that God uses this message to help you experience a deeper, life-changing relationship with Jesus, because Jesus changes everything. Enjoy today's message.
So this is our third week in the Advent series, and we're just walking through the opening of Matthew's gospel. And a couple of weeks ago, we started and we looked at the genealogy in Matthew, which seems kind of boring when you're just sort of reading it and you don't understand all that Matthew was trying to communicate through that genealogy. And then last week, we saw really the birth of Jesus, but we saw it in a unique way that Matthew tells the story through the lens of Joseph, this remarkable man who believed what seemed to be impossible. And it changed his life, and it changed and affected so many other lives as well. And then this week, we're coming to this next part of the story that's going to sound really familiar, but I hope that we can just sort of for a moment put all of what we think we know about the story on the shelf, and let's just kind of try to wade into it again with fresh eyes and ears, if you would. So just follow along with me in Matthew chapter 2. It says this: after Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, during the time of King Herod, magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, "Where is the one who has been born king of the Jews? We saw his star in the east and have come to worship him." And when King Herod heard this, he was disturbed, and all Jerusalem with him. And when he had called together all the people's chief priests and teachers of the law, he asked them where the Christ was to be born. "In Bethlehem, in Judea," they replied, "for this is what the prophet has written, 'But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah. For out of you will come a ruler who will be the shepherd of my people Israel.' And then Herod called the Magi secretly and found out from them the exact time the star had appeared. And he sent them to Bethlehem and said, 'Go and make a careful search for the child. As soon as you find him, report to me so that I too may go and worship him.' And after they had heard the king, they went on their way, and the star they had seen in the east went ahead of them until it stopped over the place where the child was. And when they saw the star, they were overjoyed. On coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshipped him. And then they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold and of incense and of myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their country by another route." Have you ever missed your moment? When I was in college, I was at Northwestern University in Chicago. We're part of the Big Ten, and we have a football program. That's sometimes the best way I could put it. We have one. And in the Big Ten, we're not really at the top, right? That's Michigan, Ohio State, Penn State keeps trying, you know, hard. And so Northwestern was, when I was there, we were pretty terrible. We were kind of at the bottom of the barrel in the early 2000s. And we would go to the student game, you know, get student tickets and go to the games, and it felt like kind of a glorified high school game to me, being from Texas, I'll be honest. But we would get some of these big teams in there, you know, Michigan, Ohio State, and we would just get trounced. You know, they would just kick us upside, you know, one side of the field and down the other. And this one year, though, Michigan was coming to town. And a bunch of my friends had tickets, and they said, "You got to go to the game." And I said, "I don't want to go." Because I knew I was going to work the late shift the night before. I wasn't going to get home till 2 in the morning from this coffee house that I worked at, and I wasn't going to get bed till 3, and I was looking at the weather, and it's freezing outside. It's awful. I said, "No, I'm out. Like, I don't need to go and watch us get beaten down by the Wolverines. Like, the game's going to be over by halftime. I'm not going to waste my time." And so I stayed home at my apartment, and they went to the game, and of course, that was the year that Northwestern pulled one of the greatest upsets in college football and upset Michigan Wolverines. And the students stormed the field and they brought the goalpost down. It was chaos and amazing and exuberance and euphoria and all the rest of it. My friends came back on cloud 9 so excited, and I had missed the game. I missed it. You ever missed your moment? You ever had a moment like that in your life that you look back on and you're like, "Man, that was the moment. I wish I had seized that moment." How it might have changed your life, might have changed you. And maybe you got busy, maybe you're tired like I was, maybe you got stuck in traffic, maybe you hesitated for whatever reason, but you did not seize the moment. You let that moment pass by. And maybe for some of you, it still haunts you, kind of like that Northwestern game haunts me a little bit, especially when I see my friends, you know, who were at the game, and they still remind me that they win, and I was not there. We get haunted by some of those regrets from the past, but I think maybe what can be even more haunting are all the moments that we missed and we never even knew it. You know, I have a few moments in my life where I look back and I wish I had done things differently, but what really makes my head spin is when I wonder if there are all those moments that I missed so completely I never even knew they were there. What if there was a moment in your life that was so significant that it would have changed the whole course of your future, and you missed it so completely you never even knew what you missed? See, what's so interesting about this story, as Matthew tells it, this account around Jesus' birth, is that there are these people who are looking for the Messiah, but they're not the people that we expect. That there's a whole group of people, and they're the likely people. These are the religious leaders and the scholars within Jerusalem, and they are the ones who study. They know everything about God and the Messiah, and they've been wondering and speculating, but they're not the people who go and look for him. They miss their moment. It's a whole other group of people that come into Jerusalem, and they say, where is this Messiah? And they go, and they find him. And so in verse 1, I just want to start back at here. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem. When I was a kid, I loved the Christmas carol, We Three Kings. Everybody know We Three Kings? Such a great little tune. We were at a party last night, a little Christmas party we got invited to. And you ever stumble into a party, you have no idea how awesome it's going to be. Like, I thought it was just going to be like this little dinner party. And about a little while, we're upstairs. And they're like, all right, we're going to the basement. I'm like, what? We're doing what? I thought they were talking about sending the kids to the basement because that's what you do with the kids. We left the kids up here and we went to the basement. And it was a karaoke night. I didn't even see it coming. They have no idea, but my birthday will be at their house this year. They don't even know. But it was incredible. And like, we're singing We Three Kings, and people were singing in different languages. It was spectacular. It was so fun. We Three Kings. One little problem, they weren't kings, and there probably weren't three of them. It's a great Christmas carol. Otherwise, it just has nothing to do with what Matthew tells us. See, we sort of invented some of these things around We Three Kings because we were like, well, look, there's three gifts, so there must have been three of them. Actually, they probably traveled like in a caravan. It's probably a whole entourage of these people coming from the east, and they weren't kings. Most likely, we looked at this, and there were two things. We saw that these gifts are very kingly gifts, right? These are wealthy gifts, like fit for a king. Surely they were coming from kings, but also in the Old Testament, we see hints of prophetic words being spoken about how when the Messiah comes, foreign kings will come and worship him. And so people over the years began to read that into the story and created We Three Kings. But all we really know is that they were what most Bibles will translate simply as magi, right? Some will say wise men. That's because we don't want to talk about what magi are. So magi, if you look in history, magi was originally a title that was given to the priests in ancient Persia. But over the centuries that followed, it became kind of a general term for anyone who was what we might think of as a religious guru. Right? These were mystics. They were astrologers. They were magicians. And they were astrologers like these people. And they were looking in the stars and divining the future. But the reason that our Bibles, just to be very candid with you, the reason our Bibles translate this as wise men or leave it as magi is because we all know that there are certain people who should not show up in the Christmas story. Right? There's just the wrong kind of people. Like, you don't put sorcerers and magicians. Like, the Bible is against those things. I mean, for real, if you look in the Old Testament, it denounces sorcery and astrology. Like, why would you want to look to the stars for your future when you have God? That's the whole logic here. God created the stars. You don't need the stars to tell you your future. You have God who is leading you. And so God very explicitly in the Old Testament says you should have nothing to do with divination or astrology. And so these are the people that they shouldn't be in this story. These are the wrong kind of people. They don't belong here. And so we'll sort of sanitize this because we don't want them in the story. It kind of gets weird. I mean, why would God be revealing himself to people who are astrologers? Don't you hate it when God doesn't play by even his own rules? It's like he made them and he gets to do whatever he wants. It's so frustrating because we like to find the rules that God creates, and then we like to be very legalistic about those rules, don't we? This is the only way. that God can reveal himself. We know better than God how he can speak to other people in other parts of the world. And we know the right kind of people and we know the wrong kind of people. There's the right kind of people. These are the people that God reveals himself to. And these are the wrong kind of people. And these are the people that God doesn't care about until they get their act together. See, I learned this really well growing up, because not because of my church or my parents, but I went to a Christian high school of a denomination that will remain nameless. And they were very good. And it was very clear about who the wrong kind of people were. The wrong kind of people are people who dance, who play cards, who watch rated R movies. I could go on with this list and then associate with other people who do those same kind of wrong things. Now you are the wrong kind of person, and God will have nothing to do with you until you get your act together and become the right kind of person. See, we're pretty good at this, aren't we? And so what they did in my school is they created this beautiful little pristine community of all these people who looked like the right kind of people, which was great until we graduated, and then all my pristine-looking friends walked away from God. But see, this still happens within sadly, churches today all the time. I still hear from church people, and they talk about how, like, this is the right kind of people. Church is for these types of people. And of course, when they describe them, it's them. Right? Isn't that weird? Is that convenient? It's always the right kind of people. They look like us. And we don't like the wrong kind of people. And I think the reason for this is so simple. It's because we're afraid. I mean, just to cut right to the chase, I think that, and I'm speaking for myself here, and I'm guessing some of you can identify with this, we prefer people who are like us. It's so much easier to love me. Like, why would I want to try to love people who aren't like me? It's more comfortable, it's safer, it's more convenient. And so long as all of you are more like me, then I don't have to have the courage to love people the way that God loves people who aren't like me. And see, when the Magi, this whole caravan of people not from around here, they come moseying into town with their whole, we don't know if they were camels or whatever, they're coming on, and they come into town. There is no self-respecting Jewish person in there who is like, oh yeah, that makes sense. Oh yeah, absolutely, God is speaking to those people in those other parts of the world. No, for them, this is their Messiah. This is their God. Like, God shouldn't be speaking to those kind of people. They are the wrong kind of people, and yet here they are. They've just come into Jerusalem, and they're messing everything up. And understand that when they got there, they didn't get there because they'd been looking through the Hebrew scriptures. They got there because God spoke to them through a star. If they'd had the Hebrew scriptures, they could have followed the Hebrew scriptures. But they didn't have them, and so God, because he is so gracious, because he is so good, because he is so kind, he condescended to them and said, oh, you're looking for me over here in the stars, then that's where you'll find me if that's what it takes to get you where I want you to go. Years ago, I was invited to a lunch, and I was supposed to meet a man who we were supporting at the time through our church, working with this phenomenal nonprofit organization that was providing education for women in Afghanistan, which is a very dangerous and a very needed and amazing thing to do. But I thought we were going to have that conversation. Instead, he brought a friend and said, "I want you to meet my friend." And he is an Afghani man who is a believer. And he said, "I brought him over here because I just want more people to hear his story about what God is doing among those people." And we sat down, and I'll never forget, I'm sitting there across from him. He's a little guy, he's about 5.5 feet tall, and just super sweet, unassuming. And then he begins to tell me his story about how he grew up in a very devout, as you can imagine, Muslim community. Never wondered about anything outside of Islam. And when he was very young, though, this was a very violent area. And there were mines that were planted, there were explosives, there were gunfire, and through some of the violence, he actually lost the lower part of his leg when he was only 12 years old. And he became a very angry young man. And he hated life, and he hated everything around him, and he was just angry all the time. Until at some point, as he got older, he had this dream. And in this dream, he understood that there was this book. And he didn't even understand what it was, but somehow he knew it was a Bible. Wasn't sure what a Bible was, but he knew he needed to see what was in the Bible. And he was smart enough to realize he couldn't just start asking around. But he began very quietly to whisper and to ask and realize there was no chance of finding a Bible there. In fact, if he kept asking, he might have lost his life. And so at some point, he realized he was going to have to leave his community, his area, and even his country. And he decided he was going to travel to Turkey in search of a Bible. I don't know how far you had to go recently to pick up a Bible, but I guess it wasn't as far as he did. And he began to travel, not with people that would have been safer, but by himself. And he stuck to the, you know, back roads where nobody would find him, because if he was picked up by one of these warring tribes, he could be killed, he could be taken back, he could be taken captive. And so he's living on the land, starving, freezing, heat, whatever the circumstance, whatever the weather is at that time, right? He gets his way to the border of Turkey. He has no passport, he has no money. He has to become part of the black market in order to smuggle himself across into Turkey also that he can get his hands on a Bible. And when he does, which is not exactly the most religious free place in the world, but compared to Afghanistan, it was better. And over a series of course, coincidental events, he managed to find a Bible and he met Jesus. And it changed his life forever. If you're feeling guilty about how hard it is to get up on a Sunday morning to come here, I get it right now. Like you should feel that a little bit. I do. The lengths that he would go to meet God. I have had so many conversations with people over the years who have tried to explain to me that the God of the Bible can't be the true God, because what about all the people who never hear? And they've tried to tell me that God is basically geographically challenged. He's locked wherever he is, right? And so if you're born in a community that's Muslim, then you'll be Muslim. If you're born in a community that's Buddhist, you'll be Buddhist, and so forth. And so the only reason that we're Christians is because somehow magically we're at a place where it's predominantly Christian of all the religions, and so that's why we're Christians. And I got a couple of responses to that real quick is remember that this is not where Christianity began. Okay, so understand that God has always been on the move. Right, it begins in Israel where God reveals himself, but then it begins to spread and it goes to Europe and it comes here. And by the way, we are not the center of Christendom today. God is blowing open doors all over the world, and more people are coming to faith in him and through the gospel and giving their lives to Jesus all over. This is not the epicenter of Christianity anymore. You got to look to South America or Africa if you want to find that. So God is always on the move. He is not geographically constrained in any way. But here's my other response. Don't you think that if God created all of the universe, and he created every single person, and he knows every single one of us better than we know ourselves. Don't you think if he is that powerful and he is that loving and that creative, that he could find a way to reveal himself to whoever he wants, whenever he wants, however he wants? And see, there is almost, humanly speaking, there's almost no chance that these magi would come searching for the Messiah any more than the man from Afghanistan would make his way all the way to Turkey just to find a Bible. But they did. And so they came all the way, hundreds and hundreds of miles, probably from Babylon, we think. They came all this way over here because of a star. And we don't know the connection that they made between the star and this new king of the Jews. We don't understand that connection. We have speculation. We can sort of make some guesses. But all we know is that God met them where they were. He didn't say, when you get your act together, come and find me. He didn't say, when you start reading the Bible, they didn't have one. He said, wherever you are, I will meet you there. And he sends them on this incredible journey to Jerusalem and beyond, all to meet a God they did not yet know. Verse 2, and when they arrived, they asked, where is the one who has been born king of the Jews? We saw his star in the east and have come to worship him. And when King Herod heard this, he was disturbed, and all Jerusalem with him. There's a lot of speculation about why Jerusalem was disturbed when when King Herod was disturbed. And some people just said, well, look, when King Herod gets upset, everybody gets upset because he's the king and he sort of like shakes everything up. I think that's possible. I think one of the reasons, though, if I had to guess as I've been thinking more about this, I think the reason that all of Jerusalem is disturbed is because they had begun to believe that God belonged to them. See, this wasn't three kings who kind of like snuck in. This was a caravan. Like when they show up, everybody knows they're there. And this makes no sense to their grid of how God works. Like God belongs to them. He is their prize. He belongs to them. The Messiah is their Messiah. And yet here come these people. Like who do they think they are? They're so unlikely. And yet God has somehow revealed himself to them. And now they're here to look for the Messiah. Like who do they think they are? By the way, can I tell you that when you begin in your journey to take God seriously and to really seek him, you need to know that that is gonna make other people very uncomfortable. There are people who are, they're gonna come alongside you and maybe they'll try to be positive and they'll try to encourage you, but deep down, they're afraid that you're gonna get weird, all right? And what's more is that as you become more and more serious about your relationship with God, despite all of your best intentions, so long as they are not following you in that journey, they will begin to distance themselves from you. Because by your very seeking God in a way that they're not, you are creating this question within them of maybe they should. And it might be even someone who's convinced that they don't believe in God at all. And I'm telling you, even then, as you take your faith seriously, as you seek God seriously, then even for them, there will become this nagging doubt, a beautiful doubt, that maybe, just maybe, you're right. See, when the Magi show up looking for the new king of the Jews, the Messiah, it makes everyone uncomfortable. Everyone's disturbed, starting with Herod, but I think for a different reason. See, Herod was crazy. And Herod would do anything to hold on to his power. Herod was, he actually wasn't Jewish. He was Idumean. He was from the Edomites, if you go back to the Old Testament. But he had come to power because there was all sorts of political infighting going on right before him, and he seized power, and he was better at keeping the peace than everybody else, granted through sheer brutality and fear, but it was effective. And so Caesar, Rome, right there over all of this area, they grant him the title of king because he's doing a pretty good job. He keeps the peace, he keeps stability, everything's going the way that Rome likes it. Rome doesn't want to have to interfere. And so Herod becomes king, but understand, he is despised. Like he is absolutely hated by all the people in Israel, right? And the reason very simply is because one, he's not Jewish. So here is a non-Jewish king sitting on the throne in Jerusalem. They don't like that. But also he's a horrible person. I mean, he's mean, he's brutal, he's killing people. In fact, he was so despised, I love this, that when he was lying on his deathbed, he gave the order to round up all the Jewish leaders who were beloved and to move them into an arena. And that at the time of his death, they were all to be slaughtered so that when he died, the country would be in mourning, even if it wasn't for him. See, Herod was sick. I mean, he was insane. And he wanted so desperately to hold on to power. In fact, he wanted to hold on to power so desperately that he had his favorite wife, he had a lot of them, but he had his favorite wife strangled because he thought she was plotting against him. Turns out he was wrong. One of those mistakes you really wish you could take back. He also had several of his sons murdered because he thought they were plotting against him. Again, turns out they weren't. In fact, Caesar at the time, he was said to have quipped that it was safer to be one of Herod's pigs than one of his kids. See, for Herod, the idea of this new king, this is not the news he wants to hear. Like when he hears this is why they've come, where's the king of the Jews? His mind begins to spin, like how am I gonna take care of this? Because this is not what he wants to hear. In fact, in some ways, this could be what he's been dreading all along. I mean, if you're sitting on the throne and you're not Jewish over the Jewish people, you have to wonder if at some point they're gonna try to overthrow you and put someone who is Jewish on the throne. But not just that, there was this rumor. This is so interesting. There was actually a rumor, like a legend going around the region for centuries that had been building, that there was a Jewish ruler who would come to the throne. This wasn't just in Jerusalem. This wasn't just in the surrounding region, but throughout the region, throughout many, many neighboring nations. There's an ancient historian named Suetonius, and he puts it this way. Throughout, listen to this, throughout the whole of the East, there had spread an old and persistent belief. Destiny had decreed that at that time, men coming forth from Judea would seize power and rule the world. See, there was this fear that somehow in Judea, somehow in this tiny little country, there would be rulers. They weren't sure, not good at the specifics, but there would be some power arising there that would dominate the whole of the world. See, it's not just Herod who is afraid. It's not just Herod who dreads this. The neighboring countries they hear this rumor, this myth that's in the air that maybe, just maybe, something could come out of Judea. But this is Herod's worst nightmare come true. But he's not panicking, right? Herod didn't get where he is by panicking and freaking out. No, he's shrewd. Like, he knows how to handle this stuff. Stay calm, right? Take it a step at a time. He needs more information. And so he's working out a plan. He's a schemer, but he wants to set them up to do what he needs them to do. So verse 4, when he had called together all the people's chief priests and teachers of the law, so first he needs some information. So these are the religious leaders and the religious scholars in Jerusalem, and he asked them where the Christ was to be born. In Bethlehem in Judea, they replied, for this is what the prophet has written. But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah. For out of you will come a ruler who will be the shepherd of my people, Israel. This is a prophecy from the book of Micah, the Old Testament prophet. And so now Herod has the location. He has the information. Now he summons the Magi. Verse 7, then Herod called the Magi secretly and found out from them the exact time the star had appeared. He sent them to Bethlehem and said, go and make a careful search for the child. As soon as you find him, report to me so that I too may go and worship him. I love that. Herod is a conniving, evil despot, but man, he's good at his job. He's good at what he does. And he's so convincing that evidently the Magi, they don't know his reputation coming in from a foreign land, and they buy what he's selling. They're like, okay, we'll go along with that. So verse 9, after they had heard the king, they went on their way, and the star they had seen in the east went ahead of them until it stopped over the place where the child was. And when they saw the star, they were overjoyed. Isn't it odd how the star works? I always found this really interesting. I mean, here's the star. They're over in the east somewhere, and they see the star, and they follow the star to Jerusalem, but then it's like they lose sight of the star. The star is just sort of there, and then they hear from Herod's people, right, these religious scribes and scholars, where they're supposed to go. So then they start on their way to Bethlehem, and as they go, now the star begins to move, and they're overjoyed. I always wonder, like, why not just send them to Bethlehem? Why didn't the star just take them clearly to Bethlehem? Why the detour? Why are we going through Jerusalem? Could have saved a whole lot of trouble if we just gone straight to Bethlehem. But I got to tell you, I think this is how God often works. I think God often gives us only the information that we need for that moment. He only gives us enough information to get us moving on the first leg of our journey. And I think he does that because if he was to tell us our final destination, it would be so tempting to take that information and leave him out of it. It would be so tempting to say, God, I got it from here. Thanks for telling me everything I need to know. I don't need anything more. I'll send you a postcard when we arrive. Nice knowing you. I'm off on my own. I think that would be our temptation, wouldn't it? But instead, what God wants to do is take us on each leg of the journey, and he gives us only the information that we need as we go. I think the other part of this is that the reason that God takes us on what feels like detours and dead ends is because he's actually protecting our future from us. Because if he moved us into the future that he has for us, but we're not ready, then we will make a mess of it. And what he's really doing is he's giving us time to develop, time to grow, to become the people that we need to be, the character and the faith that we need, so that when we arrive in that future, we can actually handle the future that he's created for us. When I was 13, I met the woman that I would marry, spend the rest of my life with. I was 13 years old when I met Carrie. And when I saw her at 13, I looked across the room and I thought, that is the woman of my dreams. She was 11. And I just thought, I'm going to spend the rest of my life with her. No, I didn't. Not even close. Are you kidding? I'm 13. I'm not hanging out with little 11-year-olds. I'm cool. I'm in middle school. I'm not hanging out with 11-year-old. Like, that's not how this plays. So we were not friends for years. Like, we knew each other. Our circles kind of overlapped. I knew who she was. But we met at 13, and it would be years. I was going to leave. We went our separate ways, go to college. I go to Chicago. I go to Italy. And it was years later that suddenly it's like we met each other for the first time. And in some ways, that's exactly what happened, because we were not the same people that we'd met when we were 13 and 11. If we'd been the people when we met and we'd never changed, the 13 and 11-year-old, we would not still be married today, right? We had a whole journey, a whole, like, this part of our life that God took us on this journey, and he grew us, he changed us, and he changed our character, he deepened our faith and our relationship with him. All of this changed about who we were, so that when he actually brought us together, we were ready. We weren't the same people that we had been before. See, maybe you're frustrated because you feel like God has you on these detours in life. And when they feel like dead ends and you're frustrated, you're like, God, I'm ready for that next leg of the journey. Like, I want to go over there. I want that job. I want that kind of career. I want that kind of family. I want that kind of, you know, I want that relationship. I'm waiting for that guy or that girl who's going to, you know, complete my life. And you're waiting for all of that. And you're like, God, why aren't you giving that to me? Maybe, just maybe, it's because you, if he gave that to you now, you would mess it up. You are not the person who can handle the future that he has for you, but you'll get there. You'll get there if you will rest in this space, if you will take the time to seek him in this space he has you in now, because in God's economy, can he tell you, there's no detours, there's no dead ends unless you create them. Right? He's not taking you on that to hold you back. He's taking that because he wants to change who you are. And those moments where you feel so stuck, those can be some of the richest times in your life, where he is doing some of his deepest work in you if you pay attention. And that's the key. You have to see and believe in what he's doing in you to allow him to change you into the person that he wants you to become for the future that he wants you to step into. See, the Magi, when they're following the star to Jerusalem, that's as close as they can get for them, for that moment. That's all the information he gives them. All they have is a connection between a star and a new king of the Jews. And we don't know exactly what that connection was. Maybe it goes back to that rumor that I told you about. This idea of this legend that was pervasive throughout the region. Maybe that's how they make the connection. We don't know. All we know is that God gave them the information they needed from the star to get from there to Jerusalem, but they had to go to Jerusalem because it was there that they would receive the prophecy that would lead them to Bethlehem. And it was there that they learned that God didn't speak to them just through a star, but through his scriptures. It was there that they learned that if they really wanted to follow him, it wasn't through divining the movement of the stars in the sky, but through his word. Maybe that's what they needed. And so the Magi, with this new information, are so excited. They get this information. We are going to go to Jerusalem. And so they get together with the religious leaders and scribes, and together they all go to Bethlehem. Except that's not what happened. The Magi go, and the religious leaders and the scribes, they stay. And I think this is what we're supposed to see. I think maybe this is also why God sent them through Jerusalem, not just for them, but because he wanted to shake Jerusalem up to see if maybe they would still follow him. Sometimes God takes the most unlikely people and shows us their faith in order to spur our faith on. But instead, you've got these experts, Jewish scholars, religious experts. They knew where the Messiah was to be born. Herod asked them, "Where's the Messiah, the King of the Jews, to be born?" And they're like, "Easy, man, we know this. These guys are Bible trivia, you know, geniuses. Like, they know all of it." They're like, "Micah 5, done, right? He's going to be born in Bethlehem. Check the box. We know all the answers. Would you like to go with us to Bethlehem?" "No, we're good. We're just going to hang out here." See, this should get our attention, because these are people who had spent their whole lives, generations, centuries, looking for, talking about, speculating about the Messiah who would come. And yet, when they were a measly 5 miles away, that's how close Bethlehem is to Jerusalem, like, they could basically see it from there. Like, Jerusalem's up on a hill. They can see Bethlehem, but they can't be bothered to go down there because they knew enough. and they had reduced the idea, that they had reduced the Messiah to an idea. They were content with the Messiah as an idea that they could grapple with and theorize about and know everything about, and they didn't really care if they ever met the actual person. They would rather read about him than know him. When I was little, I was very imaginative, and I was very artistic. I loved to draw, and I would draw these DC characters, superheroes. I was more of a DC person, and so I had Superman and Batman, and I was reminded of this recently because my mom sent me copies of some of these drawings she wanted me to show my kids, and not bad for 5 years old. You know, I was like, wow, that's pretty good. And you could tell who everybody is. But I would love to imagine what they would look like and in different scenes. And then I would attempt to draw them on the page. And I remember when I was 5 or 6 years old trying to imagine Jesus. Like, I just wanted to be able to picture him. I just wanted to imagine him as an actual person that I could know. Because when I went to church, they would show me pictures, and I knew that those pictures were not what Jesus looked like. I knew enough to know that. And so I would try to imagine Jesus as he really was, and I couldn't do it. Like, I would try, and it just didn't work very well. But see, even at 5, I knew that I wasn't trying to imagine an idea. I was trying to imagine a person. Even at 5, I knew that an idea could not die for me. An idea could not give his life for me. Only Jesus could do that. See, Jesus is not an idea. Jesus is not a religion. He's not a theory. He's not a DIY for making your life a little bit better, like a diet or an exercise plan. He's not a psychological trick so that you can, you know, improve yourself or self-actualize or become the better version of you. Jesus didn't come to make a better version of you. He came to create a new you. He came to give you new life, a new life that replaces the old parts of you that were never really you to begin with. And when you give your life to him, he steps into your life, he gives you this new life, and he makes you come alive in a completely new way. But if you don't know Jesus like that, if you only know him as an idea, then you do not know him at all. The Apostle Paul, he says this in Romans. He says that at just the right time, Jesus came and gave his life for us. I love that phrase, at just the right time. There's this moment, Paul tells us, where Jesus stepped into human history, and it's like there's this moment where everything hangs in the balance. Like, what will Jesus do? It's like all of human history hangs in this one moment where Jesus actually has the opportunity. He can choose, like, to give his life for us or to save his own life. And in that moment, Jesus, he chooses us. In that moment, Jesus chooses to seize the moment for our sake so that we would no longer have to be defined by our worst moments, but instead by a relationship with him. And see, if you have never given your life to Jesus, I want you to know that he is waiting for you right now. And there are some moments you cannot afford to miss. Man, I missed a football game. Who cares? We're talking about the God of the universe who loves you more than you can possibly imagine, and he wants to know you. And you can say, man, I've known about him for years, but he wants to know you. Like, he wants you to know him, there to be this relationship. Where as the song says, he walks with me and he talks with me, and you can take your relationship that seriously where you say, Jesus, I don't want to know you as an idea. I want to know you as a person, to walk alongside you, to follow you. Jesus, I want to follow you into new legs of this journey. I don't want to stay in Jerusalem. I want to go to Bethlehem. Like, wherever that takes me, whatever that takes, lead me into this new faith, because I want to know you as a person, not just as an idea. And you might be thinking, man, I'm the wrong kind of person. Like, you just showed up at this, you know, this morning because you just want to see the kids sing. Somebody drug you along. Like, you're the wrong kind of person. Can I tell you, there are no wrong kind or right kind of people when it comes to God. It's just people. Jesus died for people, not the right kind of people. He died for people. In fact, if anything, he died for the wrong kind of people because we're all sinners. But then it's just people who God loves. So I don't care who you are, what your past is. I don't care what you brought in today. You are the right kind of person because Jesus loves you, because he loves all people. He loves you. He gave his life for you. And if Jesus gave his life for you like that, then he has already done everything for you. Like, what are you waiting for? If you don't know him like that, how could you not want to? Like, seize your moment. Like, this is a moment where maybe right now God is whispering to you, Jesus is calling you to know him, not as an idea, not as a religion, not as a theory, but as the person who gave his life for you. Maybe this is your moment. This is your moment to say, Jesus, I'm ready to take you seriously in a whole new way. Maybe this is your moment where you say, Jesus, I'm tired of just play acting the part and doing the whole church thing and looking good. I want to know you. Make this your moment. Make this your moment where you say, God, I know I've been holding back parts of my life, but I'm giving all of me to you. I'm ready to leave Jerusalem, ready to go to Bethlehem. And I'm leaving all of this behind. I want to give all of myself to you and follow you wherever you want to lead me to go. Make this your moment where he changes your life forever. I want to pray for you. Before I do that, I want to give you a little time just to talk to God. And if you've never done that, I just want to tell you, this is really simple. It's just like talking to anybody. He already knows you better than you know yourself. You can't say anything that he's never heard or will be surprised by. And we're not going to like have this like, oh, we're all going to talk out loud here because he can hear you anyway. So I'm not telling you like, oh, we're all just going to start chanting or something like that. What I would love for you to do, if you would just humor me, is to close your eyes for a moment and to bow your heads. And I don't care whether you've been walking with Jesus for decades. I don't care if you have never talked to him before. I'm just asking right now, just to, in this moment, would you close your eyes and bow your heads? And I want to just lead you right now. And I don't know what this prayer is for you, but to say, Jesus, make this my moment. And you tell him, Jesus, I want this to be the moment that I give my life to you. Tell him that this is the moment that you want to give all of yourself to him. Make this the moment where you say, Jesus, I don't want to play at this. I want to take you seriously in a whole new way. Make this your moment where you say, Jesus, I believe you are who you say, and I'm tired of pretending. I want the life that only you can give. Make this the moment. Tell him right now, Jesus, change my life. Make this your moment. Say, Jesus, I give my life to you. Make this your moment. Tell Jesus, I want to go further and deeper in my faith. God, show me what that looks like. Make this your moment. Tell him, Jesus, change my life. Change my life. Jesus, you came, as we saw last week, to save us from our sins. But you didn't check a box and then abandon us. You want to change everything about us. You created us out of love. You created us for intimacy with you, to walk with you, to talk with you, to know you as we would know a friend, a brother. Lord, I pray right now that as we are speaking to you, as we're whispering to you, as we're just speaking to you in our own hearts, Lord, that this would be a moment for some of us that we take a new step of faith. Whatever that looks like for us, that we would seize this moment. Say, Jesus, I don't even know how, but I am just believing, I am trusting that you are calling me to know you more, to give my life fully to you. Lord, I pray that you would honor these prayers. Thank you that you're listening. Thank you that you always hear us. Thank you that you love us more than we can imagine. Lord, help us to seize this moment because you are the one who has seized us. That we can give our lives to you because you gave your life for us. Lord, how can we hesitate? How can we waste another moment when we know that you love us like that? Help us to seize each moment this week that we have to know you, to worship you, to be in awe of you, to follow you in faith, past Jerusalem, to our Bethlehem. We pray this in your name. Amen.
Thanks for listening to the Easton Bible Church podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's message and that God will use it to speak powerfully into your life. If you have questions about how you can have a relationship with Jesus or would like more information about our church, You can connect with us on Instagram and Facebook, or go to the Easton Bible Church website at ebc.org.